Welcome, everyone. It's such a beautiful evening. So the title of the talk this evening, No Subject, No Object, No Separation, True Love, came from my first Daisha Shin at Mount Baldy Zen Center. And it was a quote from Joshu Sasaki Roshi. So Shin is translated maybe something as touching the heart mind, and Dai means great. But to put it in simple terms, very intense retreat. And Mount Baldy Zen Center teaches Rinzai Zen, which is notoriously very intense, and Mount Baldy proudly said that they called themselves the Marine Corps Zen. So just give you a little flavor of what it's like to be there. And Joshu Sasaki Roshi was a tough old Zen master who died at the age of 107 4 years ago. He was probably in his late 80s, early 90s, my first time out there. I did catch him napping a few times in the hot summer night days. So I want to talk about this notion of no separation and how that means, what that means in terms of true love. And when I gave a talk that was similar to this some time ago, and I didn't put the true love up because I was a little concerned about what people do with that word love and how the kind of expectations it might set up. So, but this time I don't know. I'm getting looser, I guess. So I want to maybe touch on this subject in three ways. First, I want to talk a little bit about what it's like at Mount Baldy Zen Center, what the practice is like, and how the intention of that practice is to come to some realization of this no separation. And then I want to talk about a discourse called the Bahia Sutra. Actually, I'm sorry, it's Bahia Sutta. Some teachers pronounce it Bahia, but it's an Indian name, so I Googled it, and Google says Bahia. And then I want to see if maybe we can explore, actually experientially, just doing a little exercise, if that might allow people to touch into it. So a little bit about Mount Baldy Zen Center. They teach Rinzai Zen, which uses koans. And koans are, they evolve from experiences of students with teachers where the teacher poses some sort of question and the student has some sort of realization from it. And so the koan literally means something like public record. So there's a record of all these experiences, and Doug Phillips, who many of you might know, often comes here Wednesday evenings and gives talks oriented around these practices. And there's something called the Blue Cliff Record, which has, you know, I don't know, hundreds of koans and some sort of realization. And it's not very clear what they mean sometimes, so it's nice to have someone talk about them. Many people study these koans, but Joshu Sasaki didn't want someone coming in with a whole lot of understanding from an intellectual study of koans and their answers, so he made up his own koans. Okay. And just to maybe give you a little more flavor of the center, you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you start sitting at 2:30, and you finish at 9. You get one 20-minute break, which given the cabin, and it's an old Boy Scout camp, so given the cabin I was in, it would take about 10 minutes to walk back to the cabin and 10 minutes back to the Zendo. So pretty much you're going to stay outside or something during the 20-minute break. And the monks actually told me one time, they asked him if he could maybe give people a little more time. And Joshua said, they're getting 20 minutes, so they never ask again. He thought 20 minutes was too much of a break. So it's intense. And there's what's called a jikijitsu. It's kind of like the father image. And the role of jikijitsu is to tell you every time you're not doing something right. And if I got through a morning without being corrected for something, I thought it was a pretty good morning. So there's a lot of form in Zen. You know, how you eat, how you fold your napkins, your feet have to be flat on the floor, all kinds of rules about you don't eat when the condiments are being passed. And I hate form. So I thought this is a beautiful practice for me, you know. I went there four times. I remember after the first time, I said, this is brilliant. Because you have to be alert all the time, unless you want the jikijitsu in your case. Okay. And while it was intense, there's a real aliveness to it. There's real aliveness to being present. So we go to this hall from the Zendo, which is where we meditate, to this other room where you hear a talk, where I heard this talk from Joshua, where he made this statement. And people had to cross over each other to get into the hall. And there'd just be this quick glance and bow. And it's very vibrant. So I want to talk about two other teachers' experience practicing with Joshua, and then I'll talk about my own experience. So I think I'll start with Ram Dass. Okay. So the setup is that there's a main meditation hall. You sit about a couple hour sittings, then you do some walking. Oh, and by the way, everything's in groups, so you never, other than that little 20-minute period, even the one shower you get during the 9-day period, you get marched down to the showers, and then they say, showers in, showers out, and they march you all back, right? So that's the structure. And so you're in this main hall, and then you kind of, when you're ready, you go up to this other little building. It holds a smaller number of people, and I always try to time it like right in the middle of the 2 hours, because that way I got a little break from the two-hour sitting. And you sit there and you wait for Joshua to ring the bell. And then when he rings the bell, you ring a bell back. And by the way, Mount Baldy Zen Center is a little over 6,000 feet. So it's out in California, near San Jose. And then you're supposed to run like crazy to the little cabin he's in. And then you do three prostrations. So, you know, you're breathing pretty hard. And there's this giant of a man there. I mean, he wasn't a big guy. He's built like a little fire plug. But you know, he has this kind of aura about him. And so the natural tendency is want to impress him. And so the Ram Dass tells a story about how he went there. And actually, when he came, you know, they just said, well, Dass, in your cabin 6, which is where they put people the first time you're there. And, you know, just treat him like an ordinary person. And so he goes in and you get a koan, some question that doesn't have an intellectual answer. So this is really the purpose of koans, is to break through the thinking mind, which is what separates us. And Ram Dass, I've heard a recording of these stories. This is why I can tell them. But there's a lot of interesting stories from really well-known teachers that have practiced with Joshua. So Joshua is saying, you know, Ram Dass would come in, you know, he sprints to the room, does his prostrations, tells what the koan is, and tries to manifest it. And Joshua would say, Dr. Dass, I'm very disappointed in you, and he'd ring the bell and send them off. Now, you do this 4 times a day. And you get some flavor of what that might be like to come in 4 times a day, go through all this, and have the guy just ring the bell and send you off and say, you just don't have it. And after a while, you know, you run out of answers. you start making up all these intellectual exercises. And so then Ram Dass tells a story. He got sick. He said, I just didn't care anymore. And so he came in and Joshua said, welcome, Dr. Dass, you're a beginning Zen student. So what's he pointing to? He's pointing to this sense of self, this ego, who has to be something, this willfulness. And for a brief moment, he let go of that. Joseph Goldstein, many of you probably know Joseph. I've practiced with him many, many, many months. And so he told a story when he was with Joshua. He'd go in and And the way he tells the story, he says, you know, after a while he thought Joshua was feeling sorry for him. So he gave Joseph a koan. He gave Joseph something to chant the next time. So Joseph went back to the zendo, and he's sitting there practicing, rehearsing this chant over and over and over again. And he goes in, goes through the whole bowing exercise, and totally blows the koan, the chant. Just horrible. And Joshua says, "That's very good, Joseph." Because Joseph showed his vulnerability. He said, Joshua couldn't have known it, but when I was in school, they told me to mouth it when in singing class. He couldn't sing. And there, you know, somehow he nailed his particular vulnerability, and he was open to it. Okay. Now, there's actually another wonderful story about Rafi, I can't remember his last name. He actually now has got some websites called Radical Rabbi, I think, or something like that. And he came in and he kept giving all these intellectual answers to where is God when stick hits floor. And finally, Rafi just got really frustrated. He said, God is everywhere, and God is both everywhere and nowhere, and all these intellectual answers. And then one day, Rafi said, well, I'm just going to go in and grab that stick, and he won't be expecting it. I'm bigger than he is. I'll just take it away from him, which I actually thought about doing myself. And after I found out what happened to Rafi, I'm glad I didn't do it, because what happened was that Joshua flipped him over his head. And Rafi said, my body and my ego was both bruised. So he went back in again, apparently, after, even though he decided not to. And Joshua said, I'll give you a C. And Rafi said, I've never gotten a C in my life, you know. So my story. I went in, and the koan that Joshua gave me was, where have you been now? Anybody have an answer for that one? So I came up with a lot of intellectual answers. I don't even remember what they were. Four times a day, 3 days, 12 times. Ding. And then I'd run out of stuff. I realized that what Joshua was doing is he's hitting his cane. Oops. He's hitting his cane on the floor. And I just went. So he wanted to be completely here, completely present. So when I hit the bell at the end of the sitting for those who were there, and I said, can there be only the sound, nothing but the sound? That's what I was pointing to. And when you're like that, there's no separation. There's no you outside the sound hearing it. I remember I first practiced in Zen in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and there was this wooden instrument. And the Zen teacher hit the mock, it's called a mock talk, and he hit the mock talk, and I heard his sound. And he said, only the sound. And I sort of got it, but it took another 20-some years to kind of get a little deeper. So, so this is a quote from Joshua. When I make this sound, if you are on top of it, at once you will be able to know that this sound is the voice of God, the voice of the Buddha. Your Zazen practice is to penetrate this sound, and you will know this to be true. When you hear the sound, when you see a flower, you are seeing and hearing together with God, together with the Buddha. So there's a poem by Joshua that sort of points again towards what he's trying to offer us. It says, as a butterfly lost in a flower, as a bird resting in a tree, as a child nursing on its mother's breast, for 67 years I've danced with God. So what he's pointing to is there's not Joshua watching a butterfly. He is the butterfly. He's not separated from it. And I think we all have experiences like that. And it's really helpful to start paying attention to it, because it's pointing to something profound. Maybe you just see a beautiful sunset, and before there's a thought about, oh, there's a beautiful sunset, there's just this deep connection. No one outside of it. if maybe you listen to someone, just without any reviews or opinions, just wholeheartedly there. So actually, when I heard this quote, I thought, oh, what would that be like to meet my wife like that? And I remember at the end of the Dai Shi Shin, I called her and I just said, you know, just completely there, completely listening, no judgments, no views, opinions. That's it. So there's just this pure experience with no one outside the experience. This is the profound teaching of this practice. So when the Buddha says he's teaching the end of suffering, actually the Pali word is dukkha. And there are three kinds of dukkhas. Dukkha-dukkha, which is the ordinary stuff. You know, all the loss, the physical problems we have, people saying things to you don't want to hear, having friends, being with people you don't want to be with, losing people you do want to be with. That's dukkha-dukkha, ordinary suffering. And then there's the suffering of impermanence. You just can't line it up. Everything changes, everything. And the third, called sankhara dukkha, is a sense of someone outside the experience. And this is what the Buddha is talking about bringing an end to. You can't end the dukkha dukkha. You can't end the fact that everything's impermanent. But you can end the sense of someone outside the experience. And so just having moments like that and paying attention to it really can begin to shift your practice. I see some puzzled looks, so we'll go on here. By the way, you're told not to take notes. I kind of would like to take notes, but I don't want to upset the center by saying, yeah, it's okay if you take notes. So, but these talks are my talks on cimc.dharmaseed.org, as well as Doug Phillips, who's given a number of really wonderful talks on this discourse I'm going to talk about now. And since I'm talking about other subjects, I'm not going to go in as much depth as Doug has. So there's this discourse called the Bhaya Sutta. And there's a wonderful story that Doug tells so well, I'm just going to cut to the chase on it. He's called Bhaya the Bark Cloth. And Bhaya, you know, he has clothing made out of bark. And he's kind of viewed as an ascetic and revered where he is. And so he starts wondering if he's awakened. And in the mythology, this Devadatta, this kind of lesser god or goddess, who's somehow related to him, comes to him and says, Bhaya, you're not awakened. You're not even close to being awakened. And not only are you not awakened, you're not even on a path to get awakened. Now, how would you react to that? But he just, you know, he takes that in. And he asks, well, is there someone who could teach him? And so she tells him where the Buddha is. He doesn't say goodbye to his friends or anything. He just packs up and he goes. That's what's called sambhega, spiritual urgency. He really wants this. So he travels all day and all night to get to where the Buddha is. Now, it's 1,200 miles, so, you know, it's a little mythical. But he gets there and he asks where the Buddha is. And he's told that the Buddha's on alms round. So he goes around, he finds the Buddha, and he says, I want you to teach me about how to be awake, be free. And the Buddha says, not now, Bhaya, I'm on alms round. And so the kind of point to Bhaya's persistence, and Doug tells about all these wonderful stories about where the teacher just slams you. You know, do you have enough to keep on coming back at it? Another teacher told me, as soon as you confront a student, they go find another teacher. So Bias really, like, he wants this, and he says, but I could die anytime, you could die anytime, please teach me. And so After the third time in the Indian tradition, you have to answer the question. So this is the teaching. It's the story of one of the fastest stories of awakening. So here's your chance, okay? He says, Baya, when for you in the scene there's only the scene, when for you in the herd there's only the herd, and so on, for each one of the sense experiences, and then when for you in the cognized there's only the cognized, he says, then there is no you in connection with all that. There's no you hearing, there's no you seeing, there's no you thinking, it's just happening. Now, Mark Epstein was here, it was the last weekend, I don't know if anybody came, but you know, he has a book called Thoughts Without a Thinker. And then he says something that needs some interpretation too, but he says something else that needs some interpretation. He says, when Baya, there is no you in connection with that, there is no you there. This is pretty hard stuff here. When there is no you there, then by here you will... When there is no you there, then by a you are neither here nor there nor in between. Now, what is he talking about? In Buddhism, part of the Buddhist model is there's something called contact. So contact is when a sense door, like say, for example, the ear, hears sense object, the sound, and the knowing of it, which is consciousness. There's two kinds of consciousness. For the most part, though, in Buddhism, it's a very simple thing. It's just the knowing that occurs when a sense door contacts a sense object. So when there's no you here, there, or in between, here is the sense door. There is a sense object, and consciousness is the knowing of it. So he's saying there isn't any contact taking place. I don't know how to explain that, but it's quite profound. The thing is that there isn't any sense of you there. So there can't be any sense of a sense door contacting a sense object you're knowing. But there is still something, maybe I'll use the word awareness. There's something knowing, but it doesn't belong to anyone, and it doesn't separate anything out. And then he goes on to say, this is the end of suffering, when you realize this, when you practice like that. So let me give you another example. You're probably all, your eyes are up here, and you see this old man up here saying some inscrutable stuff, right? And there's a sense of distance between. So there's a sense door contacting sense object, the knowing of it, and there's a sense of space arises, right? But what's actually happening? Photons are coming into the eye, right? And the mind interprets those photons and turns them into some visual image, just like a camera would do. And then there's an inference the mind makes that I'm seeing some object. So if someone were here and they were, 100 yards away, they look very small to me. And out of experience, I understand that, well, they're just far away. But this whole notion of space and separation is created by this inference. Not only that, time is created. Time is created by what's called perception, which arises with contact. That perception labels certain thoughts the past and other thoughts the future. So now we've got time and space. And there's an experience, it's called Adamayata. There's a nice book called The Island, and there's some copies of it in the library by Ajahn Pasano, I can't remember the other author, where they actually, most of the time the Buddha talks about what negates things. But this book actually tries to pull together what the Buddha really meant by awakening. And in that book, there's a description of something called Adamayata, which translates something like not made of that. And that not made of that includes this experience of no space, no time. Okay. So, of course, Bayo is immediately freed from this. And then later he gets gored by a cow protecting his calf and dies. And the Buddha says some beautiful poem after that, which I'd like to talk about, but I don't have time to tonight. So the Buddha is speaking directly to us. This is not philosophical. He's telling us how to train the mind. So maybe just explore this a little. When he says only, what does he mean by that? He means that there's no image, no memory, no thought between the experience. Well, there isn't any memory, image, or thought. There's just the experience, period. Add nothing to it. So from a practice perspective, you can think about maybe someone insults you or some way you feel, someone blows a horn at you and you can't go anywhere because there's cars in front of you, or you have a pain in the knee, or maybe you feel a great form of grief or joy. He's saying, don't add anything to it. Completely open to it. So sometimes you'll hear the expression, if you're a sad Buddha, be completely sad. If you're sad, be a sad Buddha, which means be completely sad. Don't resist it. And resistance is actually what creates separation. If you really open to the emotions as they are, they're not pleasant, unpleasant. There isn't someone who's experiencing them. So I had an experience with someone very close to me quite a few years ago where there was a great deal of uncertainty about whether they would recover or not. And my wife and I were lying in bed, and I started crying. And she said, somebody had to cry. Because there was such a release from it. Okay. And fortunately, a person who I use this example all the time isn't here tonight, so I get rolling eyes. Can't you come up with another one? I remember one time during that experience where, this was going on for, maybe a month, I don't know. And so I was walking out the door, and I was locking the door. And in that moment, I felt the pressure of the fingers on the key. And there was nothing else there at that moment. So the Buddha's asking us, and this is maybe a sense of which we could talk about this love. He's telling you, love life as it is. Just complete acceptance of ourselves, of the moment, exactly the way it is, adding nothing to it, completely open to it. So this is really a deep practice. It's really asking a lot of us. But we can have moments like that. I was on a retreat in March, and I was on the Cape where, as many of you know, they had a blizzard. Well, they had a northeaster, lost power for 3 days, and actually where I was, the particular place I was, I only got close to getting flooded out. And then they had a blizzard in the middle of the month, and I got sick. And so then that's a practice. Can you open to that? And it's humbling. But when I found myself getting caught, I'd ask myself, what am I adding to the experience this moment? So maybe the body feels terrible and you're sitting here like, well, what am I doing here? You start adding all that stuff. And just, can you just be with the unpleasant bodily experience? Not just. It's hard to be with the unpleasant bodily experience. Believe me, I'll testify. It's very humbling. And so a lot of practice is learning to open to experience, to be with our experience but not lost in it. And there are a lot of techniques to do that. I'm not going to, you know, we can have a discussion about that tonight if people want to raise issues about it. So I'm going to close with reading a quote from it's a request to Avalokitesvara, who's I can't remember if it's a male form or a female form of the Bodhisattva, but at any rate, it's a, you know, the god or goddess of compassion in Buddhism. And it says, "We evoke your name, Avalokitesvara. We aspire to learn your way of listening in order to help relieve suffering in the world. You know how to listen in order to understand. We evoke your name in order to practice listening with all our attention and open-heartedness. We will sit and listen without any prejudice. We will sit and listen in order to understand. We will sit and listen so attentively that we'll be able to hear what the other person is saying and also what the other person is leaving out unsaid. We know that just by listening deeply, we alleviate a great deal of pain and suffering in the other person. So evoking the name of Avalokitesvara is to practice the art of listening." So isn't that a form of love? To just completely listen, to listen so deeply you hear what's unsaid as well, without any prejudice, any views, any opinions. And part of the way to do that is to really ground yourself in the body, to bring the energy down into what in Zen we call the hara, the area below the belly button, or I guess in Tai Chi and Qigong, it's the Dantian. It's to learn to bring the energy down there. So just try it sometime. When you're listening to someone, see if you can ground yourself in the body. Okay. So I want to try, I was trying to come up with some different ways to get some sense of this. I can only come up with one. I tried a few others with my wife and my kid, and I dismissed them. So that's the only I got left. So just sit in a comfortable way. We'll only do this for a minute or two. And just say to yourself, "I am sitting here." Now drop the "here," so "I am sitting." Now drop the "sitting," "I am." Now drop the "am," simply "I." Now drop the "I." So what's here right now? Without any thought, without any thought, how do you know there's an inside and outside? Without any thought, is there a past or a future? So what knows? Okay. All right, so thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.